look at nearly every movie John Wayne starred in, right? He's the hero who is going to bring order through violence. You know, he needs to subdue the Native Americans, the Mexicans, the Japanese, the Vietnamese, and this kind of proved their heroic masculinity by subduing non-white populations.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, Director, and today we're continuing our Search for Meaning series, and we're examining the benefits and failures of mainstream religion in America. Today it's the turn of the white evangelical church to go under the microscope. Our guest speaker is Dr. Kristen DeMay, whose book, Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. DeMay is a professor of history at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and she'll be joined by two great thinkers and historians of religion. John Butler is professor emeritus of American Studies, History, and Religious Studies at Yale. His latest book is God in Gotham, The Miracle of Religion in Modern Manhattan. Dr. Jamar Tisby is an author and historian and an expert on the Black Evangelical Church. He's written the New York Times bestseller, A Color of Compromise, and his second book, How to Fight Racism, was published on January the 5th, the day before the insurrection in DC. So welcome to you all. So let's kick off. Jesus and John Wayne, an unexpected bestseller. DeMay diligently traces how over several decades, a militant ideal of white Christian manhood has come to pervade evangelical popular culture in the United States. She delves into the hypocrisy and disconnect between purported Christian ethics and the rise of sexual abuse, corruption, and scandal within the evangelical church. Her research shows how American evangelicals have replaced the idea of Jesus of the Gospels with an idol of rugged, militant Christian masculinity, as one chaplain puts it, a spiritual badass. This shift culminated in the hero worship of Trump, who embodied the idea of protector and warrior, even if by doing this, it meant that many followers betrayed their own moral values. And historically, you went back quite a few decades to look at the origins of this, correct?
Yes.
It's not something new. I think that's what I was trying to understand.
Well, history is always about continuity and change, right? So you can certainly find elements of a more militant, rugged masculinity. And we can talk about Teddy Roosevelt. But in the early 20th century as well, there were differences too. In the case of the First World War, for example, many conservative Protestants were pacifists. Many liberal Protestants were Christian nationalists. And you also saw in the early 20th century, a number of liberal Protestants really embraced this rugged, you know, muscular Christianity, as you saw conservatives as well. So things just aligned in different ways. It's really in the 1940s, particularly the late 40s and the early Cold War era, where we start to see conservative Protestants really embrace a constellation of ideals. So you have gender traditionalism, right? Patriarchy and female submission. And Christian nationalism, really defending Christian America, and anti-communism. And so this defending Christian America is you defend the faith, and they understood themselves to be the most faithful of all Christians, and you defend Christian America. And in the Cold War, that was a military defense. So it's really in the 1940s and 1950s that you see these values really come together.
So this concept of rugged Christian masculinity and nationalism, as you mentioned, and you talk about Theodore Roosevelt's ideas, it's not new, but it's not biblical, is it?
Well, it depends which part of the Bible you want to look at, I suppose, right? You can find, you know, Jesus turning over the tables in the temple. You can find some militant imagery in the book of Revelation. And I know this because the people I write about, these are their favorite passages. But you also find a lot of teachings in the scriptures that undercut this sort of militancy, right? The idea of loving your neighbor as yourself and loving your enemies, even turning the other cheek, the whole kind of model of Jesus Christ in the New Testament of really a model that is countercultural. He wasn't the Messiah that his followers had expected him to be, right? He wasn't going to lead them into their in their battles. Instead, he was the suffering servant. He divested himself of power. So as I understand Christianity, again, you can look to the Bible and you can find a lot of different stories there. There's a lot of different verses in the Bible that you can kind of pick and choose from. But the overarching theme, as I understand it, is one that is really kind of countercultural and one of not grasping for power, not this kind of coercive power, but one of divesting of power. And that's certainly gave me a kind of critical frame where I could, you know, hold up and critique this kind of ideology that ended up embracing bringing in a lot of cultural ideals, a lot of secular ideals, right? It's no coincidence that evangelicals, when they were looking to find heroes, that they looked to men who were not shaped by traditional Christian virtues, right? To men like John Wayne. I could just as easily have called this book Jesus and Mel Gibson's William Wallace from the movie Braveheart, right? That, I really tried to find a way to make that fit in a title. But they were looking outside of Christian tradition because the Christian virtues of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control, there's a conflict there with the kind of rugged, militant masculinity, with militarism. And so, again, no surprise that they would find these heroes outside of their faith tradition, men like Donald Trump even, and then hold them up as these are the men that God has especially equipped to do what needs to be done. And they can be ruthless for the sake of righteousness.
At some point you mentioned to me that your students introduced you to this book, which was quite kind of a radical, John Eldridge's book, Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
And he says, God is a warrior, God and every man is made in his image. Well, clearly he didn't mean every man. He meant white men. And was he in fact giving tacit permission here to embrace militarism and misogyny, in your view?
Yeah, Eldridge is an interesting figure. He hasn't weighed in on Jesus and John Wayne, nor has he really stepped back from any of his writing. So I can't really speak to his intentions. But yes, his book was extremely influential. It went on to sell more than 4 million copies. So in the early 2000s, it was published in 2001, just months before the September 11 attacks. And that really kind of amplified its message. But it was everywhere on Christian college campuses, in evangelical churches. My own church was hosting book clubs on it. You know, all the guys in the dorms across this country and Christian dorms are reading this book. They actually had Braveheart dorms that were christened, and it was really, really a thing. And it did. I noticed a couple of things right up front. Yes, I was shocked by this militancy. Every man has a battle to fight and a beauty to rescue. It was so highly gendered. And as a woman reading this, I'm like, wait a minute. You know, where's my role here? My role was to share in a man's adventure and to be seductive and to kind of support a man's role. You can see this is all, it struck me as very problematic at the time and in subsequent years as well. But then yes, there's a question of race. And what I noticed very early on, Eldridge does not limit this to white men only, not explicitly at all. But when I started to pay attention to, in the early 2000s, the success of Eldridge's book fueled this kind of cottage industry of copycat books. They were a dime a dozen. And the ones that weren't selling great were still selling over 100,000 copies, right? This was a really big thing. And what I noticed that all of the heroes, they loved their heroes. They were all the same cast of characters. Theodore Roosevelt, William Wallace, right? John Wayne was popping up, General Patton, General MacArthur. I realized at a certain point, these are all white guys. And not only were they white guys, but they were white men, the majority of whom kind of proved their heroic masculinity by subduing non-white populations. So take Teddy Roosevelt, for example. Look at nearly every movie John Wayne starred in, right? He's the hero who is going to bring order through violence. And, you know, he needs to subdue the Native Americans, the Mexicans, the Japanese, the Vietnamese. And this is the motif. And so I started to take that seriously and look at how this was being deployed, who was included and who was excluded from this. And very early on in my research, I realized I'd set out to write a book about gender, and it turned into a book about gender and also very much a book about race.
So let's go back to fall 2016 for a moment, when we all saw that awful tape from Access Hollywood. So when I saw that, I thought, that's it. He's done. Great. What a way to go. And of course, the converse occurred. The reporter got fired, but people couldn't seem to get enough of him, including women. So was this a watershed moment for you, Kristen?
It was. Yeah. I think for so many of us in 2016, I had actually been working on a project exploring the religious history of Hillary Clinton, and I had been watching very closely as kind of the response among different folks to her campaign. Particularly, I was watching white evangelicals, and it was not very positive, if you recall. So I was watching very closely, but from that angle, and I saw already in August of 2015, we had the first surveys coming out pointing to this grassroots support for Donald Trump among white evangelicals. Before any of the big name leaders were on board, we were seeing this in the survey data. And so I was watching that very closely for the next year and just watching that groundswell. You know, eventually leaders came on board, and by fall of 2016, it was striking. And then we had the Access Hollywood tape. And yes, we all kind of held our breath. What's going to happen now? Surely this is too far. And, you know, we had a couple of evangelical leaders ever so briefly waver, and then they prayed about it and were right back on board within the week. And that's when it did really strike me that it was in that moment that this previous research, I had started researching evangelical masculinity back in the early 2000s, back when my students had brought me John Eldredge's book. I spent over a year researching evangelical masculinity and militarism. And then I had to finish another book, and I had three kids, and I just always meant to come back to it. And it was in those days after the Access Hollywood tape release that all of a sudden that old research came back to me. And I realized that the language that I was hearing evangelical leaders use to justify their support for Donald Trump was exactly the same language that I had encountered in this literature, you know, 15 years earlier, that we need a warrior. Right, evangelicals were saying around 2016, he's our ultimate fighting champion. We need a man who will do what needs to be done. You know, not somebody who's cowed by political correctness or gentleness or any of these things. And all of a sudden this research came back to me, and it was this daunting moment where I thought, I think I know what might happen here. And it was really after, of course, the election, that's when I thought, yes, I need to do this. I dusted off the old research, and that's really the origins of Jesus and John Wayne.
So talking about the internal corruption going on in the evangelical church, in June of this year, The Atlantic wrote a very interesting piece entitled Scandal Rocking the Evangelical World. And it really dealt with the very public departure of Russell Moore from the Southern Baptist Convention, which they said shook the Christian world. Well, for those who don't know, Moore was president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is the policy arm of SBC, which is the largest Protestant denomination in the United States. And Russell had been quite an influential critic of Trump, and he'd written about his disgust at the sexual abuse within the church and the lack of racial reconciliation. He'd written about that. So do you think he triggered many other people to follow?
I don't think he did trigger people to follow. I think in some ways he was following others who had already left. But he was certainly, you know, extremely high profile defector. He and Beth Moore in particular, you know, they really caught the national media attention, and they certainly caught attention within the evangelical world. Two of the most prominent Southern Baptists, two of the most prominent evangelicals in this country, really, who said enough is enough. And so what we're seeing is this kind of new divide. The old alliances are kind of breaking down and new boundaries are being drawn. You know, I was watching Beth Moore and Russell Moore so closely when I was writing Jesus and John Wayne. So as a historian, I'm used to actually writing about people who are dead. And so this book kind of stretched me up into the present, literally like to the moment. And so as I was writing, I was watching this play out in real time, and I kept wondering, you know, what is Beth Moore? What would she think of what I'm writing? Because I think I can explain her situation a little bit. Same thing with Russell Moore. Like, I see what's happening here and they are in the thick of it. Where for a long time, I think these differences aren't new within white evangelicalism, but these differences that are now impossible to ignore, the kind of pro-Trump, anti-Trump factions, had been papered over for a really long time with niceties, with using the same language, the same, you know, claiming the same theology, claiming that we, you know, have unity in Christ. And in fact, a lot of people kind of bumped up against these boundaries for decades, really. And people have been quietly leaving evangelical spaces or being forced out of evangelical spaces for a very long time. I think that Jamar could speak eloquently to this, what this was like for many Black Christians who found themselves in white evangelical spaces, who are deeply committed to working on this racial reconciliation project and spent years, if not decades, of their lives. And at various times, you know, eventually said this isn't working. It's not worth it. Folks who experienced in local settings, cases of abuse, spiritual abuse, sexual abuse, many of the survivors were the ones who ended up being pushed out of their communities, pushed out of their churches, as people circled the wagons and protected the pastors, the perpetrators. And then we can talk about LGBTQ folks as well, right? Who wanted a space within this tradition, and many of them were also excluded. So a lot of people have been leaving, but then to have two figureheads, white evangelical leaders themselves, no longer finding a home. I mean, that has been remarkable. Did they motivate more people to leave? I don't think so. I think everybody's situation is kind of, it's local. And so people have been leaving before, people are leaving now. I hear from many people who are trying to change the course of their institutions, of their churches, of their Christian schools, their colleges. They are inspired to bring change, to work for justice. And 9 times out of 10, maybe 99 out of 100, they get stymied. They run into the power brokers in these organizations, in these institutions, and they're the ones who end up leaving. So I don't know that Russell Moore inspired people to leave. I think he's representative of a pattern that's happening across American evangelicalism.
I'm aware that we're getting lots of questions. It's only fair to include. So Patrick Harris says, what would you suggest for an insider in the white American evangelical world who wants to start these conversations within the tribe? How do I best use my social capital to bring this conversation to the forefront? So, Jamar, do you want to try that?
So here's the thing. 2021 is not 2011, it's not, you know, 1981. So I think what we've seen in the past 6 to 7 years, if not past decade, people are intentionally choosing where they stand on issues of racial justice, patriarchy, all of the topics that we've mentioned. It's becoming clearer and clearer. And I believe there's a sifting happening in the U.S. church. So my first question would be, are you in a church that is Christian or white Christian nationalist? If it is white Christian nationalist, how much time and energy do you want to expend there? Because very seldom does it change. Very seldom. I'll temper that with this. Maybe you're there for a season. But I do want folks to realize seasons come and go. So maybe you're there for a season now, but that season may not last forever. And we do have the opportunity now. We've always had it, but I think we see it more clearly because of the pandemic, when we were forced outside of physically meeting in a lot of cases, to re-envision what church looks like and what community looks like and what faith communities look like. So I mean, I would do a whole lot of soul searching. Don't guilt trip yourself into staying somewhere and trying to fix it and change it. Was it Maya Angelou who said, when people show you who they are, believe them the first time? Folks are showing who they are. And it is up to people who want to faithfully and closely follow Christ to determine whether the community they're in is the place where they can do that best. You know, the scriptures say that Jesus is going to build the church. The gates of Hades will not prevail against it. But that congregation is not the capital C church. And so I just say that as with a pastoral bent and with a heavy heart, knowing how much trauma and fatigue and weariness and disillusionment and bitterness results when you're trying to change a place and a people that don't want to be. Now, I'm not saying that's never ever going to happen, but I think we need to do some deep soul searching about why we think it's only in this place or only with these people where Christ can be found or what must be found in our experience.
There's been some debate about the preciseness, usefulness of the term evangelicalism to describe the sorts of phenomena that we've been discussing today, with some scholars starting to move toward the term Christian nationalism. To what extent are these two terms in legitimate competition with each other? And if they are, do you view the shift toward using the term Christian nationalism a helpful one? Finally, how is this dynamic complicated by the fact that Christians who supported Trump have begun to self-sort into evangelicalism? Self-sort. Okay, who wants to take that, Christian?
Sure. That's a great set of questions there. And yes, we just saw survey data come out just a couple days ago, right? That although we're focusing on people who have left white evangelicalism over this, more have actually joined, who are identifying with this cultural and political understanding of the term evangelical, essentially, you know, to Trump supporters. So would it be better for us to not, are we really not talking about evangelicalism, and should we use the more precise term white Christian nationalism? I think we can use both and in different contexts. So white Christian nationalism is really helpful to kind of name precisely this set of values that that we're talking about. And so Taking America Back for God is a great book by sociologists Andrew Whitehead and Sam Perry that just give us very clear tools that we can talk about this conservative white evangelicalism. It's patriarchal, it's nationalist, racist, and all of that. I'm still talking about evangelicalism, and a huge subset of that happens to be white Christian nationalism. And often the power dynamics are such that that is the dominant strand. But I'm also talking about evangelicalism more broadly, right? As this religious movement, as a culture, as a religious subculture. And that's where things get really interesting. Because again, I'm reminded every single day that white evangelicals and that people who identify as conservative white evangelicals are reading Jesus and John Wayne, and they are my biggest proselytizers out there. They're having book clubs. They're challenging each other. And again, not the majority, so numbers here matter. But to understand that, one of the things I try to do in this book is try to get at, who are evangelicals? And I end up kind of settling on they are in many cases, we can think of them as a consumer culture. So not necessarily as people who believe in particular theological doctrines, but these are people who may be exposed to this evangelical culture through a mega church. It may be through Christian radio, through Christian music, through Christian television, talk radio, all of these different things, right? And Christian publishing. Christian publishing is this massive industry. And this is what shapes the values of evangelicals. Many of them end up being drawn to conservative political values. We could say 81% of them do, but that still leaves us with this 19%. And these are people who are in the same churches, in the same communities, the same organizations, often the same families. And that's what this evangelical reckoning, such as it is, it is right now, that this is, it's so painful in so many cases, because even though like the needle isn't really shifting, right, in terms of the institutions and the leadership, very little movement there, but the agonizing within these organizations where people are just looking at each other across this gulf that has become visible to them all of a sudden, just saying, who are you? What do you believe? What kind of God do you believe in? Right. So I want to be able to not dismiss that still the spectrum that we have within white evangelicalism, but yes, having this tool, kind of diagnostic of white Christian nationalism is also very helpful, because that's where we can find a lot of white Christian nationalists who are not evangelicals, right? We have Catholic white Christian nationalists. We have secular white Christian nationalists if you get into this kind of God and country faith, right? And that's important. So we need both terms, and we need to be very particular about how we're using them and how they interact.
And I think it's important just to say, for folks, there's been this movement in the scholarship from very early on when historians were writing about evangelicalism. It was a very sort of almost formulaic theological, primarily theological description that they were putting forth, which almost invariably failed to capture really the dynamism and diversity of evangelicalism. And it's only recently, I think, in the past 10 years or so, and certainly the past several years with books like Jesus and John Wayne, that folks have said, you know what, checking these, you know, theological boxes isn't really capturing what evangelicalism is and has been, particularly in the U.S. So let's do something like Dr. Dumais does in as a cultural historian. So what are they consuming? Who are they holding up as heroes? And how is that actually a more sort of broadly encompassing idea of what evangelical is and has meant? And as she stated, is constantly changing over time.
Well, I've got two more quick questions I want to get in. I don't know if we can answer both of them. One, somebody here has said Christianity prospered during the 1920s and 30s with the advent and explosion of radio. Some preachers rose to fame, others were shut down. How did that decade shape evangelicals? Does country music and its stars have an impact in shaping some of the sexist, racist Christian history you're speaking about? Wow, that's a good question.
I'll take a stab at that. One of our problems is we generally think, if you listen to a general historical lecture, that religion failed in the 1920s and 30s after the scope trial. So, but we know better than that. That simply didn't happen. And there was a huge, the denominations, the Catholic Church and denomination really prospered in that period, despite the Depression, all kinds of problems with religion in the Depression. A lot of congregations did fail, but they also prospered. And so I think that it's one of the ways that we misunderstand our history. And therefore we misunderstand important elements of the way we became what we are.
Interesting.
I'll say this as well. It continues to confound me, and even more, how many people still overlook religion writ large as a massive force in history and particularly in politics, and then specifically evangelicalism, right? So back in the 70s, when Jimmy Carter came on the scene, journalists were like, what is this evangelicalism? What is this born again? Are there a lot of people out there who believe this stuff? And it's already this massive cultural and growing political force. And I'd say there's a similar dynamic happening even now. If you look at the manufactured hysteria over something like critical race theory, it hit the political scene in the past year or two. But I would say those fault lines have been present within Christianity and particularly evangelicalism for years, if not decades before. And so we do ourselves a disservice as, engaged community members if we are overlooking the role of religion and then Christianity and evangelicalism, because a lot of these things have been present and are only just becoming, there are some people who are only just becoming aware because they haven't looked into these pockets of religion.
Okay, so I'm going to thank Kristen DeMay, John Butler, and Jamar Tisby for making the time. I thank you all. Cambridge Forum is made possible by Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, the City of Cambridge, and you all. So don't forget to donate. Go to the website www.cambridgeforum.org, where you'll find a podcast of this program and lots of other forums. You'll also find details of upcoming programs and past programs. Thanks for listening.